Dust Hill this year around the world. And finally this hour, a new poll in the U.S. shows a majority of young Americans are in favor of either decreasing or stopping military aid to Israel. Hello and welcome everyone, your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Starting off at this hour in the Gaza Strip, which has seen fresh Israeli attacks and strikes as the regime continues to violate the ceasefire agreement with Hamas. There were airstrikes and artillery shelling on the southern city of Rafah. Also in the south, Israeli gunboats opened fire off the coast of Khan Yunis. In Gaza City, the regime forces detonated an explosive-laden armored vehicle. Several neighborhoods of the same city also witnessed fresh airstrikes. Israeli attacks were reported in the El Burej refugee camp as well. Nearly 380 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza since the ceasefire took effect. And in the broader picture, the genocidal war since October 2023 has taken the lives of over 70,300 people. Well, now joining us from Deir al-Balah with the latest is our correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim. Ghada, as always, thank you very much for joining us. Ghada, again, let's just remind ourselves that even though the world media, Trump and other leaders proclaim that there's a ceasefire going on in Gaza, that is not the reality on the situation on the ground. The genocide continues, the humanitarian situation continues. What updates do you have for us, Ghada?
Yeah, we are now one Israeli captive away from moving into the second phase of the U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement, which must allow more Israeli withdrawal from the yellow line areas or behind the so-called yellow line areas towards the eastern borderline along the Gaza Strip. However, on the ground, the situation is different. The Israeli occupation army is widening its attacks in the areas behind the so-called yellow line and even expanding these and widening these yellow line areas, like what we witnessed yesterday in Khan Yunis City. In the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City, the Israeli occupation army has advanced towards Salah al-Din Street, which is actually around half the areas of Khan Yunis City. And also we have witnessed this previously in the eastern parts of Ash-Sha'af, Ash-Shuja'iyah and At-Tufah neighborhoods. These areas were also subjected to very heavy attacks, and Israeli occupation army has already widened its presence and its firepower in these areas and relocated the yellow demarcation blocks in these areas and included more areas in the so-called yellow lines. This actually means that more attacks are taking place in areas that are completely populated and crowded with families and crowded with displaced families behind the so-called yellow line. This means like the Israeli occupation army is including more areas that are populated in the circle of its attacks, considering them as more yellow line or yellow line zones. On the ground, these attacks and these violations of the ceasefire agreement are continuous. And until now, since the beginning of this U.S. brokered ceasefire, until this moment, we are still witnessing more attacks behind the so-called yellow line, particularly in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City, in the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah, like Al-Burej and Al-Maghazi refugee camp, and also on the eastern parts of Gaza City, like Ash-Sha'af, At-Tufah. And to the north, we are witnessing more attacks towards Jabalia and Beit Lahia areas. So the situation on the ground is really tense. As these attacks are taking place, Israel occupation army is racing the time to demolish and to level to the ground what is remaining behind the so-called yellow line in areas like the eastern parts of Khan Yunis, and more areas are completely wiped out. And in areas like Ash-Shuja'iyah, as what we witnessed yesterday, the Israeli occupation army is until this moment is still detonating the heavy or the explosive laden reports in order to level to the ground the houses that are still remaining or the infrastructure that is still standing behind the so-called yellow line.
Exactly, Ghada. I'm afraid I'm going to go ahead and cut you off there. Ghada Ibrahim, everyone, our correspondent there, joining us from Deir al-Balah with the latest updates on the situation in the occupied Palestine. Well, Israel's military chief has openly labeled the so-called yellow line in Gaza as, quote, a new border line for the regime. Addressing Israeli troops inside the Gaza Strip, Eyal Zamir claimed that the yellow line serves as a forward defensive line for the regime. Israeli forces withdrew to the yellow line in October as part of the first phase of the Gaza ceasefire agreement with Hamas. Since then, the Israeli army has constructed new concrete outposts along the line to reinforce its positions. However, satellite imagery indicates that some markers have been placed hundreds of meters beyond the boundary outlined in the ceasefire maps. Israel has also continued carrying out strikes on Gaza, despite the truce that requires a full withdrawal of the regime forces from the Strip, with the exception of a small buffer zone. Well, students from the University College London and pro-Palestine activists have held a rally just outside the campus gates to commemorate Palestinian poet Rifaat Al-Ariyad. Al-Ariyad, who was killed 2 years ago in December 2023, along with his family members in an Israeli bombardment of Gaza. 2 years on, the University College London has yet to condemn his assassination. We have talked to some of the demonstrators, and here's what they have to say.
Well, this event has been organized by the students to honor this great poet and this great. He's probably best known by his poem, If I Should Die, really. But as I said, I think the poem is more than just a poem to his family and his children. It needs to be interpreted very much like a vision, a poem of the future, that it's about Palestine, it's about freedom, that the people of Palestine will have their freedom.
He was a student here in UCL. He was a student of comparative literature. And 2 years on, we still have heard nothing from UCL management, even acknowledging his quite horrific murder, his targeted murder. He was singled out and killed. And it's quite horrifying and heartbreaking that not only was he killed and they didn't acknowledge it, but that UCL invests in the very companies which facilitated his murder in the first place and the genocide of hundreds of thousands more in Gaza.
So today we're here to commemorate the Professor Rifaat Al-Ariyad, who was assassinated in Gaza 2 years ago, and he was an alumni at UCL. And as Rifaat Al-Ariyad says, you can kill a revolutionist, but you can never kill the revolution. And as students here, it is our job to keep fighting for revolution. And as long as we are here, we are thriving, we will never give up. Until Palestine is free, nothing else is free.
Crossing now over to the Italian city of Milan, where pro-Palestine demonstrators have held a protest denouncing media silence on Israeli crimes in Gaza. The protesters gathered at Milan's Piazza della Scala, waving Palestinian flags and holding banners reading No Colonialism. They stressed that mainstream media has muted the Palestinian narrative for 2 years. The participants also condemned Italy's Minister of Culture for cutting funds for cinema and the arts while redirecting resources to the arms industry. Reporters Without Borders says Israel is responsible for nearly half of all journalists killed worldwide this year, describing the regime forces as the worst enemy of journalists. In its annual report, RSF documented the killing of 29 Palestinian reporters by Israeli forces in Gaza since December 2024. According to the report, the deadliest single incident was a so-called double-tap strike on a hospital in southern Gaza on August 25th. RSF data also showed that since the start of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza in October 2023, nearly 220 journalists have been killed. This as foreign correspondents remain barred from entering Gaza, despite repeated appeals from press freedom groups demanding access. Well, Israeli forces have stormed an Urnawa compound in the occupied El Quds, seizing property and tearing down the UN flag. The raid has sparked condemnation from top UN officials, who describe it as a violation of international law. We have a report.
A brazen act of aggression by Israel against the compound of a UN agency. On Monday, the regime forces raided the headquarters of the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, in the occupied city of El Quds. They cut all communications, seized furniture, IT equipment, and other property, and confiscated the mobile phones of security guards. Israeli troops also took down the UN flag
and raise the regime's flag. The raid has drawn sharp criticism from senior officials of the United Nations. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said the site remains UN premises and is inviolable and immune from interference.
In reaction to this event, I can tell you that the Secretary General strongly condemns the unauthorized entry into the United Nations Sheikh Jarrah compound held by UNRWA, located in occupied East Jerusalem by Israeli authorities. This compound remains United Nations premises and is inviolable and immune from any other form of interference.
Also in a social media post, UNRWA's Commissioner General said the raid is a direct challenge to international law. Filippo Lazzarini said the storming followed months of harassment that included arson attacks in 2024, hateful demonstrations and intimidation, supported by a large-scale disinformation campaign, as well as anti-UNRWA legislation passed by the Israeli parliament in breach of its international obligations. In late 2024, Israel's Knesset passed two laws to ban UNRWA from operating in the occupied Palestinian territories. The move was in line with a campaign to dismantle the agency under the pretext that it was infiltrated and influenced by Hamas. The U.S. has also cut off aid to UNRWA, citing Israel's unfounded claims. After the laws were adopted, warnings came in that UNRWA's humanitarian operation could be crippled, and that education and health care for tens of thousands of people in Gaza and West Bank would collapse.
Political commentator Mazen Qomsi earlier joined us with his take on Israel's raid on the UNRWA headquarters. He told us that Israel, as a rogue regime, has disregarded all United Nations laws.
Certainly, taking over a UN building protected by United Nations Charter and any country, any state, any region that wants to join the United Nations has to sign agreements that says they will obey UN laws. They will obey the sanctity of these sites. Israel, obviously, as a rogue state, as a genocidal apartheid state, has not respected any UN laws since its joining the United Nations in 1949, including the pledges it made about the refugees and others in 1949. So actually, legally, the UN could expel Israel for its violations, not just this violation, but all the previous violations before that. All of these things make Israel a rogue state, which should be expelled from the United Nations. And there's increasing voices, of course, but as you pointed out earlier, you know, it is not enough to say condemn this attack or feeling worried about this, and such statements don't move anybody. What needs to be done is direct sanctions, direct application of international law, and force.
While the occupied West Bank has witnessed fresh Israeli raids and settler attacks, the regime's military stormed Berzit University near Ramallah, detaining several staff members while settlers set fire to Palestinian vehicles in Bethlehem. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Naqat Hamad, earlier joined us with the details.
Let's start from there, where the Israeli forces, special Israeli forces, have infiltrated into Al-Am'ari refugee camp in Al-Bira city. Until this moment, and according to local resources, the infiltrated force started immediately shooting live ammunition and tear gas canisters against the Palestinians in the area of Al-Am'ari. This refugee camp is actually located in Al-Bira city, but to the north of occupied Al-Quds, and it has been under systematic attack. Many attacks happened towards Al-Am'ari. That was not the only attack that is going on, and that is not the only attack that is going on in Ramallah province. If we are to stay in Ramallah, in the village of Shukba, the Israeli forces and the Israeli vehicles and bulldozers are moving towards Shukba to perform another demolishing operation in that village. that has already had 14 homes have been demolished inside Chukba, and now the Israeli forces are moving into demolishing more. Staying in Ramallah, also staying in Ramallah, the Israeli forces throughout the night have raided Beer Zeit University to the north of Ramallah.
Well, a new poll in the U.S. shows growing anti-Israel views among the youth, and that most of the young Americans are opposed to the current level of military aid to Tel Aviv. The poll conducted at Yale University indicates that nearly two-thirds of Americans under 30 are in favor of reducing or ending military supplies to Israel. Half of the respondents believe that Israeli-owned businesses should be boycotted over the war in Gaza. The survey also highlights diminishing support for Trump and the Republican Party, with young voters overwhelmingly disapproving of the U.S. president's job performance. Many believe his economic measures primarily benefit billionaires and the wealthy. Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. For more updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear brother and sister. Welcome. This is today's special from IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for choosing this program to listen to, where we're going to speak about living a blessed life.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in life. That often lies, 'cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Today is Tuesday, 18th of Jamadi Uthani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 18th of the month of Azar, 1404 of the solar calendar, and the 9th of December, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Now we open Allah's book and we use its light to find our way. For today, we learn more about verse 159 of chapter Al Imran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Fabima rahmatin min Allahi linta lahum walau kunta faddan ghalidhal qalbi lanfaddu min hawlik. فَاعْفُ عَنْهُمْ وَاسْتَغْفِرْ لَهُمْ وَشَاوِرْهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ فَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ الْمُتَوَكِّلِينَ.
So by mercy from Allah, O Muhammad, you were lenient with them. And if you had been rude in speech and harsh in heart, they would have disbanded from about you. So pardon them and ask forgiveness for them and consult them in the matter. And when you have decided, then rely upon Allah. Indeed, Allah loves those who rely upon Him.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The content of the verse works as some general instructions, but the revelation of the verse is about the Battle of Uhud. The Muslims who had ran away in the Battle of Uhud and were defeated were burning in the fire of regret, remorse, and sorrow. They gathered around the Prophet and apologized. Then the Lord issued the command of their general pardon by this verse. Also, beside contemplation and consultation, do not forget to trust in Allah. Consultation and reliance in Allah are beloved with Him, whether we attain the aim or not.
Shukran ya Rabbi, shukran. Hadayta qalbi, shukran. Qawwata darbi, shukran. Shukran ya Rabbi,
shukran ya Rabbi, shukran. Hadayta qalbi, shukran. نورت دربي شكرا شكرا يا رب
شكرا يا رب
يا منزل القرآن يا خالق الإنسان يا رب يا رحمن شكرا يا
How we can live in a completely blessed life. A long life can indeed be a source of precious good. The claim that life is evil and that living it is better than enduring it is nothing but nonsense, completely disconnected from Islam. Life is an opportunity that must be seized. Remaining in it is a means for greater purity and perfection. Every moment a person spends in this worldly life is a chance to accomplish something. Therefore, it is not permissible to frown upon life, to turn away from it, to despair of its means, or to withdraw from its path. So the point is that Allah has given blessings to man in this world, so he should use these blessings for the success of the hereafter.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, today we have another topic to discuss about. If life is a blessing, are we looking at the life as a blessing? So let's have a look at the view of Allama Tabatabai in this regard. Allama Tabatabai says, with regard to the meaning of life, it says and offers another interpretation stating that some of the earlier understanding of this phrase, such as paradise, happiness, and independence from creation, are actually results of a good life, while others, such as faith in God and knowing Him, are prerequisites for attaining this kind of life. In Tabatabai's opinion, this verse refers to a new real life granted to believers, which differs from the ordinary life that all humans possess. According to him, a good life, free from any evil or corruption, is not separate from ordinary human life, but rather a higher stage of it, which some people achieve. The Quran explains the characteristics and nature of life and compares it with the hereafter in some verses, such as Surah Al-Baqarah, verses 85 to 86. The material life of beings, especially humans, on earth is referred to with the descriptive phrase Al-Hayatu Dunya, the life of this world, which is mentioned over 60 times in the Holy Quran. In Surah Al-Hajj, verse 5, the stages from the beginning to the end of this life are also described. This life begins from dust and through the formation of a sperm drop, a clot, and birth ends in death. This descriptive phrase, when compared to Ad-Darul Akhra, the adobe of the hereafter, means the present or near life. The Quran presents the concept of eternal life, which is the desire and goal of all, in a way different from the pre-Islamic Arab understanding. They sought eternity in this world, but since this was impossible, they fell into futility.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, in your hearts. A day you'll always remember every bar.
Today's a special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
Again, think about it. How to lead a good life. Undoubtedly, there will always be challenges in life, but that doesn't mean that one cannot experience a good life. The Quran particularly mentions about the good life in Surah An-Nahl. Allah says in chapter An-Nahl, verse 97, "Whoever does good, whether male or female, and is a believer, we will surely bless them with a good life, and we will certainly reward them according to the best of their deeds." Whoever strives to do good, whether in ease or in difficulty, and remains faithful to Allah, will be granted a good life. Conversely, in Surah Taha, Allah warns us, but whoever turns away from my reminder will certainly have a miserable life. Then we will raise them up blind on the Day of Judgment. Question: what actions increase barakah in one's life? When people neglect time, they tend to regret it in later years. Many people look back at their high school and college years wishing to have done greater good with their time. The Prophet informed us in a famous hadith, there are two blessings many people waste: good health and free time. In other words, many people waste their good health until they are ill, and then they regret not doing more with it, and same with time. Life only increases in responsibilities and commitments for the productive believer, and there is no concept of true boredom for Muslims who values very precious minutes of this short life. Some people were given only 30 years in this world, but we are able to accomplish more in quality than people who live decades longer. The believers are those who do the best with their situation, living each day as though it's the last, and not procrastinating goodness for a future that may not arrive.
So, what is the good life here? If life is a blessing, then what is a good life from an Islamic perspective? The phrase Hayatan Tayyiba in Surah An-Nahl, verse 97, offers a clear explanation of this usage in the Quran. According to this verse, Allah grants a good and pleasant life to believers who perform righteous deeds. Commentators have contrasted this with an ma'ishatan danka, difficult life. And they believe this good life can occur in this world, in the barzakh, that is intermediate state, intermediary world, or in the hereafter. The commentators have also interpreted this good life as lawful sustenance, contentment, paradise, happiness, faith in Allah, performing acts of worship, experiencing the sweetness of obedience to Allah, attaining the ability to worship, independence from creation and turning to Allah Himself, and knowing Allah and being truthful before Him.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of today's special, which in that way speak about a blessed life and the ways, of course. Follow us. Thank you, and fi amanillah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Aliyud Imami, Lafata illa Ali, Aliyud Imami. علي إمامي علي إمامي
لا إله إلا الله الله ربي
محمد نبي علي إمامي
لا فتى إلا علي علي إمامي علي إمامي علي
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
My father lost his arm before he chose to have children. He lost his arm during the war. And then it took him 7 years to cope with that and feel that maybe he was mentally able to help raise a child.
The things that he had seen, he would always have flashbacks and he suffered from PTSD really bad. From all the things that he did and saw while he was in the war. And he was very abusive and he was very violent. And he would black out at times and think that he was still in the war. And there was times like we would get up in the middle of the night, me and my brother, and we would try to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and he would be like hiding under our beds and grab our feet and pull us under the beds. And I mean, he had PTSD really bad.
He suffered flashbacks, lots of flashbacks. Many nights he'd wake up moaning and groaning, screaming and yelling in his sleep.
They would put him in the helicopters and stuff, and they'd fly him all over and drop him off in the jungle, and they would get out of the helicopters, and the helicopters would leave him out there, and there would only be like maybe 30 guys. They were hiding everywhere, and he couldn't really run through the jungle because everything was booby-trapped, and there was pits with the spikes in them, and landmines everywhere and trip wires, and they had these big logs that had a bunch of bamboo spikes on them, and they'd put them up in the trees. When you'd walk by and you'd trip a stick or whatever, it would fall down out of the tree and impale people. And there was, he said there was times that while they were on the battlefield that he would have to go and, like, his friend would be walking right in front of him and he would step on a landmine and pieces of his friend would fly all over him, and he would have to pick up the pieces and put them in his backpack and carry them out.
He spent a lot of time by himself, very quiet. We were raised with war decor in our home, lots of Vietnam memorabilia, pictures and videos and books and that sort of thing. So it was always around us, and we always knew what had happened to our father. We never knew him any other way, so we always knew what had happened to him.
He just couldn't take it anymore. He tried to drink the pain away. He tried to work it away. He tried to tell me and my brother everything that he went through. He tried talking about it. He tried everything. And when he first got there and everything, he was just out of high school, and what he encountered when he got over there was not what he expected at all. One of the missions that he had got sent on when he first got here was that they went into a village, and the whole time I've been here, I've been trying to ask people and everything. And the other day, we were at another VAVA office, and we were there with the general, and when he started to open the book, it was mentioned that my father was in Chu Lai. Everybody that was in there said, "Oh, Chu Lai." And it kind of made me start to think, well, what went on in Chu Lai that was so bad that everybody knows about it? And he was explaining all that. But then when he found Chu Lai on the map, he pointed at it and he cried and shut the book and pushed it away from him. And that really hit home, because that's where my dad was at. And then when we got to the museum and I found where his company and everything was at, and I saw it on the wall, and then I saw where they slaughtered all them women and children. And my dad was only 19 years old when he joined the military, when he came to Vietnam. So at 19 years old, that's what they told him to do. And they made him kill women and children. And there was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. It was 500 women and children. And like 70-something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he still had 13 more months to go after he had to do that. And he had to go through, I don't even know how many villages they dropped him off at, that they had to do the same thing, because that's when, during the war, it turned into basically a genocide, and everything that was out there, they killed it. Men, women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, everything. They just went out there and they killed everything that they came in contact with.
in the sense that he followed directions that he did what he was supposed to do. However, he harbored a lot of guilt for many, many years about the things that had happened here during his time and the things that he was told to do, the things that he had to do in order to survive. He had terrible nightmares.
Another part of that story is that the Vietnam veterans in general were shunned by, you know, World War II veterans and Korean War veterans and things. They were not accepted when they came home by the very people they wanted to emulate. American Legions and stuff, because they didn't win the war, they weren't real soldiers and they didn't have a place there with the real military heroes. You're from Vietnam and they smoke and they, you know, do drugs and they kill people, so they're bad.
I know of twice that he had tried to kill himself, and the second time that it happened, it was Christmas. And he was having a really tough time. Christmas was very difficult for him. All of his family was already gone, and then just with the PTSD, he had taken a gun and had loaded it, and thankfully had put the wrong bullet in the gun. And so when he put the gun to his head and he fired it, it misfired and it didn't go off. But we knew about that story, and that was always something that we had feared. That he would take his own life.
I got a ride from my dad and I went back to the state of California. It was Father's Day of 1997. I was coming home, and when I got to the house, I noticed there was a bunch of police cars outside of my house, and I thought maybe somebody had hurt somebody in my family, or maybe I was in trouble or something, I didn't know. So I hurried up and I pulled in the driveway and I asked them what was going on, and they said that they needed to talk to me. So I went to the side with them and I started to talk to them, and they told me that there were some people that were riding some motorcycles and they had found my dad's body out in the middle of the desert in his car, and that he had committed suicide. And it was so hard for me because all my life my dad was always there. He always tried to help me. He helped take care of me. He helped make sure that I had my prosthetic legs and everything. And just all of a sudden, all at once, all of that was gone.
This war in Vietnam, guess what? It wasn't going like the other wars that the United States had been involved in. They think the idea that, you know, maybe America didn't win like they thought they were going to, or that there was subversive reasons for us getting into the conflict or the war itself, that America mismanaged their military, or they were after natural resources, or they just wanted land close to China. There is so much controversy just around those parameters.
The people actually got to see the war on TV. It was broadcast. They showed all the people that were getting blown up and all the kids that were getting sprayed and all the death and destruction of what the war was actually had going on in it. And once the American people saw how awful war really is, because most of the time in America, because nobody attacks America on their own soil or anything like that.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
This is the main Vietnamese language radio station in Saigon.
When the American people saw this, they started having riots in the street. They started protesting at the government. They started, like, just having all kinds of problems in the United States over it.
So many years after 1975, that it's still in infancy. Like, I don't think historians even know what to write about it. I don't think they know what's real. I don't think they know what's false about it, what's mythological about it, anything. I think at first it came out of the veteran's mouth, my kids are sick, I'm sick, and they said, guess what? You're just a bunch of baby killers. You're just a bunch of whiners. You're a bunch of drug addicts. Now you just want a free handout. That's what they were met with.
Agent Orange was a safe product when it was used in the Vietnam War, and it's a safe product today.
We don't mean to say that there isn't an Agent Orange effect, but at this point in time, we don't seem to see anything that confirms that there's something there specifically.
Just hours before, thousands of Vietnam veterans were supposed to be represented in court against seven chemical companies. There was an out-of-court settlement.
Many of my brothers have died when you sat up there and played political.
Gentlemen, we can't wait 20, 30, 40 years.
I think they just try to sweep it under the rug so nobody knows, so that people won't be trying to go, well, wait a minute, I have a bad liver, or wait a minute, I have a brother that's missing an arm and we've never had birth defects in our family, or wait a minute, now I know why you don't have any legs, and all that. And then for all the people to come together and sue the chemical company, I think that's what their issue is. I think they don't want everybody to know about the Agent Orange, because if everybody knew how awful it was, and that the government, they would have to pay for medical bills and all kinds of stuff, and they don't want to do that, so they try to hide it and pretend like it never happened.
It's just still on the cusp. It's just out on the edge. Nobody will take it and pull it in. Very famous actor in the United States, Tom Hanks, currently doing The 60s. It's a documentary series that's been showing on CNN. I waited on bated breath. You know, he's talking about the 60s and the Vietnam War and showing film and how it affected. I was waiting. Come on, come on. Nothing. I went to a speech with journalists who were here during the war, who weren't in the military but were journalists, very famous journalists in Pittsburgh a couple months ago. I waited. Come on, something. Say something. Sorry. It makes me so angry. They just erase our history. They erase it. It's gone. It doesn't exist. They don't care. And that has been what we've heard our entire lives. You're controversialist. You just want controversy. You're just making stuff up. No, it's happened. They talked about everything. They talked about the strife. They talked about this and that and what it was like to be here and how the troops were and what it was like in the... Say something. You come here as a journalist and you stayed in Vietnam. You were able to see both sides of the story. And you've been back to Vietnam. And you talk about it. Say something. You know that the children here are still suffering. You know that the Vietnam vets are suffering. Say something, nobody. You have people who are suffering, who have suffered their entire lives because of decisions people made in an office somewhere. They made the decision to spray this stuff. This is going to be a good idea. We're going to save people. People still today claim Agent Orange saved people. Okay, maybe it did. But those lives were worthwhile, and I don't diminish that at all. But there are millions of us that are suffering because of this chemical.
Seeing that the these people have taken me in. Like when we went to the Friendship Village and those Vietnamese veterans that came out, they were the NVA. They were the ones that were at war with my dad. And my dad probably shot at some of them, and some of them probably shot at my dad. And when I came face to face with those guys, that was a pretty intense moment because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if all of a sudden they were gonna have a flashback because they saw an American face, or I just had no idea what to expect. But after he sat there and looked at me in my eyes for a good minute, and he came over there and he gave me a big hug, and he told me that Vietnam doesn't want war. They don't want to hate the American people, that they just want to live in peace from now on. And
I've come and I've been able to put faces. It's been a wonderful experience to get the second side of the story. Every conflict, every problem has two sides. I've been raised with one side of the story. Now I've gotten the second side of the story, and now I can take both those elements and put them together and formulate something to share with my children.
Just like my dad, I'm not going to lie about things when I get back to the United States and try to make it look nice or do anything. All my friends and family and stuff, I'm going to tell them how my trip was.
Once I came to Vietnam, I said, okay, this is more. This is more. This is bigger. This is bigger than Heather. Because a lot of my life was trying to deal with what happened to me. And when I came here and understood that the problem was way, way, way bigger than just me, or just a few of the kids that I had kind of connected with in the United States, I understood that I couldn't go back to just thinking of me and my story and my problems and those things. I knew I had to do more.